From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. It's Politics Day here on The Exchange. This hour, we examine what is likely to be addressed in the lame duck session of Congress, including negotiations over an extension of the Bush tax cuts. Also, federal unemployment benefits are set to expire for some recipients December 1st. Senate Republicans might not make it easy to pass another extension. And Democrats hope to complete a defense authorization bill that repeals the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. Our analysts this week, Professors Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa and Dennis Goldford of Drake University. What are your hopes or fears for the lame duck session? Join our discussion after this news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Politics Day here on The Exchange. This hour, we examine, first of all, what's likely to be addressed in the lame duck session of Congress, just begun. And a little later, we'll talk about the new Congress and the 2012 presidential hopefuls already making their way to Iowa. Our analyst this week, Dennis Goldford, is professor of politics at Drake University, joining us from Iowa Public Radio Studios in Des Moines. Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us again, Professor Goldford.
It's always a pleasure.
And Tim Hagel is with us, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Professor Hagel, thank you.
Good to be here.
Listeners, we want you to tell us what's on your political mind this hour in the wake of the midterm elections so that we continue to dissect. What are your hopes or fears for the lame duck session, which we'll be concentrating on at least this first half hour? 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Republicans won control of the House of Representatives in the November 2nd election, of course. More than 100 members of the House or Senate won't be back in January. But before new representatives and senators are sworn in and the GOP does take control of the House, Congress will have a lame duck session with the current Congress. I want to ask each of you your views on what's likely to get done before this winter break. Professor Hagel, can I start with you, Tim?
Sure. Well, probably the first thing that has to happen is they're going to need to pass continuing resolutions to make sure that the government doesn't shut down. And that's pretty standard stuff. It's gotten worse, I suppose, in recent years in the sense that the Congress hasn't been able to get everything it needed to get done before Election Day. And usually when you come back in a lame duck session, a lot of times the members of Congress, especially those, of course, that didn't get reelected or are retiring, are not overly enthusiastic about spending lots of time on particular issues. So the way to go is to just say we're continuing to fund the government at the level it had previously, and they essentially leave the details to the next session of Congress.
Mm-hmm. So kick the can down the street, and then you're gone from the street by the time
Exactly. Someone
has to pick up that can. Dennis Goldford, what do you see in this lame duck session?
Certainly Congress, as Tim says, has to pass that continuing resolution and deal with raising the debt limit, something that will interestingly put particular pressure on Republicans because, of course, many in their base think that the government should be shrunken substantially and they're, as it were, constitutionally opposed to raising debt limits. But it simply has to be done so the U.S. doesn't go into a default that causes some sort of worldwide financial issue. But also, of course, the Bush administration in the early years of the 2000s left that ticking time bomb in the way of those tax cuts that were set to expire. And, of course, as we've all seen in the news, both the president and the Republicans agree that the tax cuts should be maintained for certainly people making less than $250,000 a year. The fight is over whether they should be maintained for people making more than that. So they will have to address that particular issue as well.
Okay, we want to reach out to our listeners again. What do you expect from the lame duck session of Congress? 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email. So let's delve into the tax cuts issue a little bit more. Negotiations over an extension of the Bush tax cuts are likely to be one of the dominant features of this lame duck session. Republicans, as you said, want a full extension of all tax cuts enacted by then-President George W. Bush. Obama and most Democrats favor extending the tax cuts for the first 200,000 of individuals, the first 250,000 for families. Republicans want the extension for income above those levels. Now,
let's see, the possibilities here are a compromise. We have, or the possibility of no compromise, no extension for anyone, or perhaps the Democrats conceivably mustering the votes to pass an extension only for the middle class. How likely would that be, Tim Hagel?
Well, as you put out, as you indicate, there are a couple of different possibilities. And at one level, if the Democrats and Obama hold firm to say that we don't want to extend the tax cuts to anybody over $250,000 or, you know, the individual level, whether the Republicans would blink and be say that, well, we don't want to be in a position to have it advertised that we voted against a tax cut for the middle class folks under that level. On the other hand, you could see also see where Obama wants to indicate that he did get the message of the midterm elections, that he understood what the shellacking, to use his term, was all about. And so he may be willing to at least compromise to some extent, maybe not make the tax cut for the wealthier folks permanent, but at least extend them for a couple of years. Again, that sort of kick the can down the road with the assumption on his part, his being Obama, part that he would have an opportunity later to then, as in a second term, to get rid of them.
And you see this compromise, sort of compromise, as the most likely outcome?
It's hard to say at this point. It's going to be the willingness of Obama to indicate that he's willing to reach that kind of compromise rather than to take a more strong ideological position on this.
Dennis Goldford, what do you think will be the likely outcome here?
Well, the president is under pressure from people in his own party to show some backbone. They think he's been rolled too often by the Republicans in Congress. And they want him finally to draw a line in the sand. Of course, that raises the issue on both sides, whether people are holding the so-called middle class hostage in terms of the tax cut for the wealthier people. Republicans would say that the Democrats want to deny the middle class that tax cut unless they can also deny it to the wealthier folks. And Democrats would want to say the Republicans are willing to deny a tax cut for the middle class unless they can give a tax cut to wealthier folks. So it is, as Tim said, a kind of game of chicken. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, of course, some independent folks argue that if you let these things expire, and again, it's not that the Obama administration or the Democrats in Congress are raising taxes. It was the Bush administration statute which put a time limit on them, and in a sense, they're asking the president to save them from that expiration. But according to some independent estimates I've seen, if you let these expire, you would do pretty well toward whittling down some of that deficit everybody talks about, although both are expensive. Mm-hmm. And perhaps the most likely scenario would be if the president went ahead and allowed them to extend for a couple more years. Republicans aren't going to let him decouple the tax cuts for the wealthier from the tax cuts for everybody.
Here's a question that I'd like to get answered, Dennis Goldford and Tim Hagel, because I've asked it so many times in the political campaign. And any politician will artfully dodge the question when put to them in some cases. The Democratic mantra on this issue is, in a time of huge deficits, we cannot afford to continue tax breaks for the very wealthiest Americans. The GOP mantra is those tax cuts for the wealthiest 2% will create jobs, and we definitely need jobs in this economy. So what evidence is there that giving tax breaks to the richest will create jobs that will help this economy in this situation? Tim Hagel.
Well, in many instances, you can look back and see where, in fact, that's exactly what happened, that when you gave a tax cut, certain types of tax cuts, sometimes targeted tax cuts, that it did, in fact, spur on economic activity.
But we've had these tax cuts, so this would be a continuation. So what's the difference?
Well, the difference is that right now, let's put it this way. It always depends on external factors. What's the economy doing relative to for tax increases or tax cuts? Some people will say that, hey, well, during the Clinton administration, taxes went up in certain areas and it didn't hurt the economy. Well, that's because we were riding the tech bubble at that particular time, so it wasn't much of a drag. Right now we're in a down economy and an additional tax increase. And, you know, you talk about it in tax cuts. It's not really a tax raise. Well, yes, it is, because come January 1st, if something doesn't happen, people's taxes are going to go up. So that's an increase from where we've been for the last several years. So in some sense, this is the new normal, whether that's going to expire or not. And because of the sluggish economy that we're operating in right now, an additional drain on taxes would certainly make things worse, that people wouldn't be spending, they wouldn't be out sort of fueling the economic engine, and certainly a lot of businesses, because of the uncertainty of all of this, they're not going to be hiring more people, because to hire more people requires, you know, an extra investment beyond just the salary in terms of the Social Security taxes that they pay and all this other stuff. So they'll probably try to make do with the people they have, so they're not going to be hiring, and so unemployment will stay high, and it has this sort of rolling effect on all of this. And that's the argument. Now, again, sometimes if the economy is roaring along, again, those taxes won't be a particular drag and you can siphon it off. But at this particular stage, it's not a good thing. It's going to hurt the economy even more.
Okay, Dennis Goldford, do you see it the same way, the same connection between this upper-tier tax break and the creation of jobs for this bad economy?
That's a version of the good old supply side economics argument, and I'm not an economist, and it's a tremendously complex issue, but the supply side argument, as far as I understand it, independently of whether in fact tax cuts pay for themselves, and they don't, according even to an economist in the Bush administration recently. But the argument is that the reason there's a lack of economic activity is that taxes are too high. And so if you cut taxes, particularly on the people with money to invest, they will invest because the taxes are lower, and that will create jobs. The argument on the other side, the so-called demand side, is that people aren't going to create jobs unless they're sure there's demand for their products. And so if you put money in people's pockets to spend on cars and groceries and houses and things like that, that demand will generate its own supply. So from that perspective, you give money not to the wealthier folks who won't spend all of it. They'll put it in a savings account or something. You give money to the people on the bottom half of the income spectrum because they need the money to go out and spend it. So that's the classic argument. Do you stimulate supply or do you stimulate demand?
We have a tweet from Sirawur saying, let all the Bush-era tax cuts expire. If you don't, you're really not serious about trimming the deficit. Thank you for that tweet. We're on Twitter at IPR Talk, 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email. And let's go to Don, who is in Grand Junction. Don, what do you make of this conversation?
Well, good afternoon. I believe that the liberal President Obama is not the Obama that we elected. This and herein lies the problem. The first year of the administration was spent pandering to the Republicans, attempting to get a bipartisan work, and it didn't. I would have hoped that they had spit in his face so many times that he would have picked up on the idea that, look, I've got both houses, I've got the executive branch, here's what we're going to do. But he was so set on, and rightly so, I mean, he tried. He tried. He reached out time and time and time again.
He did campaign on a sort of bipartisan, I'm a unifier type of platform. So we expected that, didn't we?
Yes. But how many times do you have to be slapped? You know, how long does it take? We would not be having, and to get to the point of this conversation, which you guys are having, we would not be having this conversation had he not taken control. We wouldn't be worrying about the Bush tax cuts. It would be a done deal if he'd taken control. He lost a lot of his base, which is why we got the slapping that we got at the polls, because he lost a lot of his base.
Okay, Don, you made your point. I'd like to get a move on. We have other callers. I'd like to get a reaction to your comments, because I think they're very interesting. Dennis Goldford, how do you react to Don's contention there?
Well, you know, a political party can give several reasons for why it sustained a series of electoral defeats. And one of them, of course, is that, well, we didn't get our message out very well. You heard Republicans say that after 2008. You're hearing Democrats say that now. But another reason they can give is that we weren't true enough to our principles. So Republicans said after 2008, we lost because we weren't sufficiently conservative. You do have some Democrats saying that the president got his shellacking or got slapped because he wasn't liberal enough. He didn't push hard enough for his programs. So it depends upon your point of view.
Mm-hmm. This week, Senate GOP leader – anyway, I wanted to go back to Don and say, Don, thanks for your comment there.
Thank you, sir.
And I wanted to Steve in Toledo says via email, seems to me the problem is that we ask the tax code to do everything from regulate the economy to social engineering. Better to have it just raise revenue, and a sales tax would do that better. Comment from Steve in Toledo. And let's go to Dave before we have to take a break at half past the hour. Dave is in Iowa City. Good afternoon. Welcome to our program, Dave.
Thank you for taking my call. I say let the tax breaks for the wealthy expire for two reasons. One, that $700 billion should be used more appropriately and effectively, putting it down toward the debt. Two, they've enjoyed these tax breaks for almost 9 years, and I've shown no evidence that them getting the tax breaks would excite investment and or hiring.
Okay, Dave, we've got a bad phone line. We got your message. We're going to let you go. Dave in Iowa City, 1-866-780-9100. Before we do get to the halfway point in this hour, this week I want to mention Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell, a previous earmark supporter, said he was supporting a ban on earmarks. And this is some words of GOP leader Mitch McConnell in the Senate on reversing course on earmarks.
Make no mistake. I know the good that has come from the projects that I've helped support throughout my state. I don't apologize for them, but there is simply no doubt that the abuse of this practice has caused Americans to view it as a symbol of the waste and out-of-control spending that every Republican in Washington is determined to fight.
Okay, Mitch McConnell there this past week. Remind us, Tim Hagel, what earmarks are and why we're seeing this move toward a ban.
Well, basically, earmarks are items put into a budget that don't get the full amount of discussion and examination from members of Congress. A lot of times it's to sweeten the deal for somebody who's wavering on a vote on some broader issue, and then they're placed in saying, well, you know, if we can get your vote on this particular bill, then we'll make sure you get in, you know, $200,000 for a potato chip museum or something like that. And this is the problem, is that, as McConnell said, that there are actually good earmarks, and it's a little bit different from what's often termed pork barrel spending. Pork barrel spending usually has the much more negative connotation that it's something that, why would somebody spend money on this? As much as it may be interesting, as much as it may be valuable in some respects, but why should the American taxpayers be spending money on this instead of raising money privately? As opposed to earmarks, which again may be something that's put in for a particular legislator, but still could be very good economically for a particular area. And so there's a little bit of a difference there. But the biggest problem is again, that folks are saying, look, we need to cut spending somewhere. This is a good place to do it. And if you want these projects part of the budget, then make them part of the whole process where they're going to get examined like every other aspect of the budget.
Mm-hmm. On this earmark question, Dennis Goldford, I want you to jump in here. Is this a partisan issue, or are there politicians on both sides of the aisle who are for and against earmarks?
There's certainly politicians on both sides. But I think the issue is one of symbolism. Now, symbolism is important in politics. But this is symbolic in a trivial sense. I mean, the figure I've seen recently is that earmarks are about maybe $16 billion or $18 billion, something like that. That's analogous to trying to fix a leak in your kitchen faucet while the house is going over Niagara Falls. There's really very little that you're going to accomplish. I mean, yeah, we certainly, and Iowa Public Radio could certainly live very well on $16 billion. But in terms of the size of the whole federal budget, that's less than 1%.
In fact, it's about a half of 1% is the figure that I saw. And I saw that $16 billion figure as well. And you're right. Maybe in the great scheme of things, or relatively speaking, it's not that much. But on the other hand, it's important because you have to start somewhere. And if you're not willing to even trim that $16 billion, how can you make the hard decisions later on? And so symbolically, yeah, you've got to make that first step. So I would say it's definitely not trivial.
Mm-hmm. So with this step by Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell, will that tip the balance? Will there be now some sort of support? How much support does this ban of earmarks have, Dennis Goldford?
Well, I think Republicans will be grousing about it, but I think they will have to support it given the energy and the emphasis on it from the Tea Party folks. And of course, you know, John McCain campaigned on that issue in 2008. McCain seemed to think the greatest threats to American civilization were Islamic terrorism and the Senate and House Appropriations Committees. And so Republicans certainly, I think, you know, in their heart of hearts may not like the ban, but I think most of them will likely support it. And I think a good number of Democrats will probably support it as well.
Okay. As we finish up this half hour, focusing mainly at Tim Hagel, you wanted to jump in there or not?
Yeah, just real quickly, the Republicans, in fact, did Senate Republicans did come with an informal agreement to ban to have a moratorium on earmarks for 2 years. There were a couple of dissenters, probably Inhofe of Oklahoma, since he's a strong supporter of them. Democrats, by and large, are not on board with this, although Harry Reid has indicated that he would be willing to bring it up for a vote, at least, again, for sort of a 2-year moratorium. By and large, Democrats are not in favor of stopping earmarks.
Okay. Democrats hope to complete a defense authorization bill that repeals the military's don't ask, don't tell policy. That path remains unclear. I think as of this day, that part of the lame duck session agenda, I think, for the Democrats. Where do things stand now on don't ask, don't tell? Dennis Goldford, can you update us on that?
I think they're in a little bit of a limbo. We've had some various court decisions raising the issue. There's a question of how far the Obama administration will ask the appellate court to support Don't Ask, Don't Tell. There's a certain pro forma element in which the administration, when a law is not clearly unconstitutional, is supposed to support the law, even if it tends to disagree with it. So they're still working that out. But certainly, you've got a case where an awful lot of Republicans, again, are opposed to changing that ban. You know, you've got the situation with even before Republican control in the House, you've certainly got that issue of Republican ability to threaten the filibuster in the Senate. So in the short term, at least, I think the chances for its repeal are somewhat muddled.
Mm-hmm. And so it would be harder in the new Congress rather than in this lame duck session of the old Congress.
Given the cultural politics of the two parties, one would think so.
Mm-hmm. To add to that, Tim Hagel?
Yeah, I think that's probably true, and it's probably not an issue that the Democrats would be willing to stop the government over. One of the questions, of course, is whether the filibuster would be one where they would force the Republicans to actually engage in that, or if the threat is enough to take that particular issue off the table. And right now, I think that given that it is in the courts, that there may be a desire on the part of some to just leave it to the courts rather than engage in that particular issue.
Mm-hmm. With about a minute left before we take a break, I want to ask both of you, just the wide open question, how much does this lame duck session matter? We've got those things that must get done. Of course, funding the government would be a train wreck if it didn't happen. We saw that happen in the Clinton administration. How much does this matter, Dennis Goldford?
It certainly matters that the debt ceiling be raised to avoid any sort of governmental shutdown. And politically, it matters certainly in terms of all these folks, aside from the ones who are leaving office, that something be done about the impending tax increases. Beyond that, I think these are mostly early skirmishes with an eye toward the new Congress.
Okay, Tim Hagel, the final words before we go into our break about how much the lame duck session matters.
I think that Dennis was exactly right, that there are a couple of things that have to get done. There are a few things on the wish list for Democrats, although whether they get on there can actually be an issue that is presages what happens in 2012 elections.
Tim Hagel is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Dennis Goldford, Professor of Politics at Drake University. They will stand by and continue with us as we go into the second half hour in just a few minutes. Politics Day here on The Exchange. We'd like to hear from you. What are your hopes, your fears for the coming Congress and also for the 2012 hopefuls who are turning up in Iowa? Newt Gingrich in West Des Moines just yesterday. Tell us what's on your political mind. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Back in just a few minutes. Great to have you with us over the noon hour. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program for National Education Week, we look at some of the hot topics in education. Governor-elect Branstad made no secret of the fact he does not support Governor Culver's state-funded preschool program for Iowa's 4-year-olds. We'll talk about early education tomorrow with an expert about what quality preschool programs look like and where the gaps are in Iowa's system. Then we examine teacher assessment all tomorrow in the hour of The Exchange. Over the noon hour today, it's Politics Day, as we always have on Wednesday. Our guests are analysts for this week. We have Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. We invite you to join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100. I'd like to pick up this half hour with deficit reduction. Democrat Erskine Bowles and Republican Alan Simpson, those are the co-chairmen of President Barack Obama's Deficit Reduction Commission, have recommended sharp spending cuts. The pair has endorsed a series of proposals, including raising the Social Security retirement age, slashing the home mortgage interest deduction on your taxes, and this is all to slash the deficit by $4 trillion over the next decade. Listeners, what do you think of this? What are your recommendations for deficit reduction? 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. On Twitter, at IPR Talk. Let's see. Let's start with you, Tim Hagel. How have this bipartisan commission's recommendations been received?
It's interesting because it's been criticized from both the right and the left, so I suppose you must think they must have done something right. It's one of those things where folks are going to look at some of the specific recommendations, or at least as specific as they were in this proposal, and say, oh, I don't want that cut, or I don't want this cut, or something else. But one of the things that the chairman of the proposal, Bowles and Simpson, said is right up front, saying, look, we're going to have to make some hard choices here. Everybody's going to get hurt a little bit, and we're all in this together. And so that means that, you know, you may not want your program cut, but everybody's going to have to suffer a little bit in order to fix this bigger problem, which if we don't get fixed, then we're going to see serious economic trouble.
Okay, and do you think there is, Dennis Goldford, the political will to make any of these deep cuts? $4 trillion over the next decade.
Well, in one sense, you could say if there were a possibility of there being such a political will, we wouldn't be in the situation we're in now. It's really difficult. I think most listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with the phrase NIMBY, not in my backyard. Mm-hmm. And everybody has some particular program that he would say that belongs to someone else and says, well, that's terrible wastefulness. That should be cut. But this one that I benefit from, this is necessary. It's in the national interest, whatever. The difficulty is, and at least in terms of the figures I've seen recently, is that five programs comprise some over at least, if not more than, two-thirds of the federal budget: Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, defense, and interest on the national debt. And you could shut down the remaining third of the federal budget. Now, that would include the Veterans Administration. That would include the FBI. That would include farm subsidies, certainly, things like that, and still not close the hole. So unless you're really serious, I mean, as Tim says, yes, you've got to start somewhere, and even earmarks are a small start. But unless you're willing to look seriously at those big five programs, and you can't look at interest on the debt, there's not a lot that can be done, at least in the short term.
Let's go to Matt in Des Moines, calling 1-866-780-9100. What do you think of these recommendations, Matt? Are you willing to go in for really quite serious cuts to slash this deficit?
Yeah, absolutely. I was really happy that they put a panel together and they actually came out with some real solutions to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so often in politics, they don't actually come up with a plan. You know, there's no plan. There's argument back and forth. And I was just really thankful that they, you know, they were able to put a plan together.
I don't know how much you know about it, but we were talking about NIMBY, not in my backyard. Do you have something that you would just be horrified to see cut from the federal budget, but you would say, you know, I realize it has to happen. It will affect me, but I realize we have to cut our budget. We have to get this under control.
There's nothing, I think, that's off the table. I mean, even Social Security pushing the age back, that's something that's hugely unpopular. But, you know, speaking for somebody in the younger generation, I don't think it's that unreasonable to think that they would push the retirement age back to 70. You know, I mean, people are living longer than they were when they established this back in the 20s, you know.
Right.
It's a reality, you know, and people that aren't willing to accept that. And Social Security, that's not a retirement plan. That's for people that, you know, that's a safety net, you know. And people are looking at this completely the wrong way.
Okay, Matt, thank you very much for your input from Des Moines. Where do we expect these recommendations to go? Will they have done any good? They made a little blip on our news radar. Tim Hagel, anything past that? Anything to work with?
Well, we certainly hope so. And I think more than anything else, what we see in this, as it's clearly labeled a draft proposal, is it starts the conversation, that it lets folks know where it's going. And in some sense, it's a matter of, well, let's throw this out there, see what the reaction is, see where the pros are, see where the cons are. They can come back and take another look at it before we see a final draft. And then at that point, it does get turned over to Congress. And so, again, it's that question of political will. And it's going to be very difficult. And Dennis is exactly right. And, in fact, this is nothing new because it came up in the Reagan administration where Reagan wanted to trim the debt. But he took a number of things off the table, and David Stockman, as the budget director, said, you know, all I've got left is 18%, and I could zero out the whole thing and still not solve the problem. So you have to be willing to make those politically very difficult decisions involving the big-ticket items.
I know,
and
both,
the problem is – excuse me. Sorry. Go ahead, Dennis. Sorry.
The problem is that the benefit tends to be diffuse. In other words, cutting these various things, lowering the deficit and such, helps us all at some fairly diffuse level, but the pain as the cost of doing that is concentrated. And that's the political problem for members of Congress. How are you going to deal with the people who are outraged over cuts? They're the ones who are angry. The ones, those who benefit don't benefit so clearly and immediately that they're willing to counteract the anger of those who are hurt.
Phil is joining us from Eldridge. Good afternoon, Phil. Thank you for calling The Exchange.
Well, thank you very much. The problem, and it's not a problem, it's a situation is that the Democrats want to consistently expand programs, you know, the liberal agenda, but not raise taxes accordingly. On the other hand, the Republicans are always looking to reduce taxes, but in the same sense, we'll not say, and by the way, these are the programs we're going to cut. So you've got a cutting both ways. The program's going up without taxes going up, and the same thing on the other side. We have to reach some point where both sides, and it's going to hurt. Mm-hmm. It's going to hurt everybody. If we want to get this in line, right, there's going to be pain across the board. And the question becomes, as a society, are we willing to take the pain?
Yeah. So what is that event? What will force our hand? Do we know that? Do you have any idea,
no,
Phil?
No, my guess would be just a situation where it becomes so frightening that the whole, you know, like, you know, the fear of a depression type of situation, or the fear that, you know, literally the whole system's going to crumble, would maybe precipitate enough people, including me, to be willing to say, okay, I'll take the pain.
Right. And I know neither of our guests today are economists, but, you know, the question on everyone's mind, because we've been hearing about deficits for decades, is – where is the precipice we might fall into? Is there even a precipice? Dennis Goldford.
Well, again, I'm not an economist, but you certainly hear people saying that there's a certain percentage of the gross domestic product that if it's goes higher than that, the deficit isn't sustainable in terms of the kinds of expenses on the part of the government and the willingness of the rest of the world to help fund our deficits by buying our goods and investing the money we pay by our buying their goods, and they invest the money that we pay them for their goods back in the U.S. If they decide not to do that, then we're in serious trouble. Mm-hmm. So if anything, I think that precipitating event might well be of financial nature, but that takes us back to the whole issue of the bank bailouts in the latter months of the Bush administration. That was a financial crisis that was averted, but so many people argued that was the wrong thing to do. But that seems to be the what would, again, not an economist, but that would seem to be the triggering event that would really concentrate the minds of people in Congress.
We've had a couple callers talking about being willing to take the budgetary pain that these cuts would mean. Tim Hagel, politically, are we willing to take the pain, our political system? Can it function to deliver these cuts?
I think that you're right to suggest that we're looking for that precipice, that we can go on and on, as Dennis mentioned previously, that we haven't shown that political will previously, and we haven't gotten to the point where we're sufficiently afraid of the consequences. And it's hard to know what's going to happen in the future if one thing or another thing happens. But we're seeing in some of the other countries like Greece and Ireland and Spain where they've sort of reached that point where their spending and debt is far beyond what the economists say it should be for their GDP. And, you know, there could be a collapse. And now that could trigger a worldwide depression of some sort, but hopefully that can be averted. At the very least, we can see, well, look, we want to avoid that situation, what's happening in that country. So now we need to get serious about it here. And so that makes that sort of diffuse benefit a little bit more real, where then people are willing to sacrifice in order to avoid that really horrible situation.
This quick email and a response from Rick in Cedar Rapids before we move on. I wanted to get to a couple of other things before our hour ends. Rick writes, why don't we accept a floating eligibility date adjusted by the actuaries annually for both Social Security and Medicare? By fixing the tax rate and making revenues equal expenses every year, both programs would be fixed permanently. Why is this not part of the conversation? Asks Rick in Cedar Rapids. I don't know if there's a response to that.
Well, I'm not exactly sure, again, also not being an economist, as far as what that would entail. But my best guess just immediately is that you have to have a certain amount of certitude in terms of what's going to happen from your budget from year to year, especially when you're talking at the federal government, and especially when you're talking a lot of the entitlements that we have. And so you couldn't have it be fluctuate too much from one year to the next.
Okay, let's move on. Dennis, did you want to get in there quickly?
Just one thing to note, though. I mean, Social Security is a looming problem, but as I understand it, it's Medicare and Medicaid that are a looming catastrophe in terms of the funding of these things.
Okay, Representative Charles Rangel, Democrat of New York. Until recently, one of the House's most powerful members was found guilty Tuesday of breaking 11 separate congressional rules. These were related to his personal finances, his fundraising efforts for a New York college. Quickly, what does this verdict mean? Repercussions at all, Dennis Goldford?
Well, it reinforces the perception of a lot of people that members of Congress think they're subject to a different set of laws from someone else. And it's exacerbated nowadays with the kind of 24/7 media coverage we have. But, you know, long ago, Mark Twain was asked by a European visitor, does America have a native criminal class? And Twain said, no, unless you mean Congress. So we've always had this view of, or people generally have always had this view of members of Congress and politicians as thinking they're in some way not subject to the same laws and rules that the rest of us are. So that simply reinforces that perception on the part of people, increases the cynicism.
Here's the words of Charlie Rangel. This is right before he walked out of proceedings. He was asking for an extension. Charlie Rangel, a Democrat of New York.
You tell me all of the things I could do, but you're not going to give me time to do it. I think no one can say that that's not the way this ends up. Yes, I can do these things, but you have to conclude this now and the next day. And my reputation, 50 years of public service, has to suffer because this committee has concluded that you must conclude this matter before this Congress ends. And all I'm asking for is time to get counsel. Time to get counsel. And you're saying now, I think, that you denied it before and you're denying it now.
Charlie Rangel there, he did not get that extension right before he walked out of proceedings asking for the extension. African-American, decorated veteran, winner of the Purple Heart, Tim Hagel, any repercussions you see here?
Well, as some have suggested, it's unfortunate that maybe his career is going to end or at least be tarnished at the end of the career by this particular thing, given the distinguished history that came before. But on the other hand, again, there seem to be some serious problems there. And as far as what he was saying there in terms of not getting counsel, he'd apparently already paid $2 million to his attorneys and they wanted more and he didn't want to pay it or couldn't pay it and had a certain amount of time to get attorneys and didn't do so. And, of course, he wants to try to delay this. But at a certain point, and even the Democrats that were on the bipartisan subcommittee agreed that it was time for them to make a decision and go forward on this. And then from this point, it goes on to the full panel, which oddly enough only includes one or two additional members. So I think that his fate, at least in terms of the charges, is sealed. Although what actually happens, it could just be effectively a slap on the wrist, a fine. It's unlikely that he would be expelled.
Tim Hagel, political scientist with us. Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. Dennis Goldford of Drake University. Winding up our hour. Before we do wind up the hour, I wanted to spend a few minutes, as we will be doing in the weeks up to the 2012 caucus, talking about the hopefuls parading through Iowa. They will continue to do so. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich says he's weighing whether to run for president in 2012. made a stop in West Des Moines yesterday. That is part of a book tour through Iowa, the latest in a series of visits by presidential hopefuls that will intensify as we get closer to the Iowa caucuses in January of 2012. Reminder here, none have formally announced his or their candidacy for the Republican Party nomination. Dennis Goldford, how do you see the race at this point?
Well, I think at the moment the big issue hanging over the whole race is Sarah Palin. The question is what she does. This is not to say she would get the nomination. Her support is an inch wide, but a mile or deep or deeper. In many ways, if she does decide to run, then the race becomes who will be the un-Palin, as it were, who will be the one who would come to the fore to counter her. The danger for those people here in Iowa and some of the other early states is if they split the anti-Palin vote, she could squeak through. But nobody yet knows what she's intending to do.
In today's New York Times Magazine, Sarah Palin is quoted as saying, "I am engaged in internal deliberations." This about the 2012 race. Tim Hagel, what would a Palin candidacy mean for the GOP?
Well, it could mean a couple of things. Certainly right now she's one of the main faces of the Tea Party movement and has played a important role. Some people think positive, some people think less so in the last cycle. And certainly if she jumped into the race, it would greatly energize a lot of people. It would also energize a lot of people on the other side. Although, given that we're talking here about the Republican nomination, in some sense, I suppose a lot of Democrats would be perfectly happy to have her get the nomination because they feel that she would be a more vulnerable candidate.
And so right, and she has tremendously high negatives in polling, and that's problematic for a candidate, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And it becomes very difficult to change people's minds. And so that's why sometimes you'll have somebody that's a lesser-known candidate that actually becomes more appealing simply because they don't have that negative, so they have a better chance to define themselves and to work on increasing their positives relative to the incumbent that we have in this particular case, which of course is President Obama.
Dennis Goldford, any dark horses you, if we were at a racetrack, you would say have an outside chance of racing to the fore?
Well, you know, that's really difficult. I mean, we've got a whole run of people from Rick Santorum and Mike Pence and Haley Barbour and Tim Pawlenty and good old Mitt Romney still around and some other names that are bruited about him. I mean, George Pataki from New York's even considering talking about it. There's normally a whole range of people who do this preliminary exploration, and then by the beginning of the year, you know, by next spring, in other words, in this cycle, they will have decided not to do anything. But so much of it depends upon the dynamics of the time. And I would add quickly, though, that, you know, a lot of Republicans do fear, and a lot of Republicans, Democrats hope that a Sarah Palin candidacy would be electoral disaster for the Republicans. But I just recall the Carter White House in November of 1979 salivating over the thought of running against Ronald Reagan. They thought it would be another Barry Goldwater and a blowout in favor of the Democrats. So you have to be careful what you wish for. So they've got to be cautious with regard to her and look seriously at alternatives.
More broadly, how will the Tea Party likely figure into the race for the GOP nomination? Tim Hagel had some comments about this before. Dennis Goldford, what do you think about the influence? We haven't had a caucus with the Tea Party influence before.
Well, Iowa's an interesting spot because the Tea Party movement tends to be somewhat more libertarian, somewhat more focusing on fiscal and financial issues and governmental powers, as opposed to the kind of cultural issues that social and religious conservatives are concerned about. They're the folks who dominate the Iowa caucuses. So that would become very interesting. Certainly, the Tea Party types don't like liberal Democrats, and the social and religious conservatives don't like religious conservatives. So the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But Iowa is known as a state in which Republican politics are dominated by social and religious conservatives. And that, to some extent, is a rival to if it doesn't push aside the Tea Party folks here in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Will the Tea Party become more of a party of a social agenda? Or will it I think it already is in many people's minds, isn't it?
There are some folks in Republican intellectual circles and conservative intellectual circles who are arguing that there is a confluence of interest. But there's still, I think, some mistrust on the part of each group toward the other.
Tim Hagel, we have 30 seconds for any final thoughts you had.
I would just say that Dennis is right in terms of that the Tea Party is generally known as for more economic-type issues, and the key for the Republicans will be to see whether they can bring those different groups into one tent. And to some extent, to whatever extent that the economy remains the dominant concern, it will tend to help to bring those social conservatives in under that bigger tent.
Okay. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Always a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you very much, Professor Hagel. Dennis Goldford, a delight to have you as well, Professor of Politics at Drake University. Thank you for taking the time.
Very welcome.
And The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. We also want to thank the listeners who called, tweeted, and emailed us during this hour, Politics Hour on The Exchange. Tomorrow for National Education Week, you want to tune in. We'll look at some of the hot topics in education, especially look at early education, preschool program for Iowa's four-year-olds, how that will change under Governor-elect Branstad. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt, technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines, we had help from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.